Chapter 23. Karaskand. For men, no circle is ever closed. We walk ever in spirals. Drusus Acamian, the Compendium of the First Holy War. Bring he who has spoken prophecy to the judgment of the priests, and if his prophecy is judged true, acclaim him, for he is clean, and if his prophecy is judged false, bind him to the corpse of his wife, and hang him one cubit above the earth, for he is unclean, an anathema unto the gods. Warrants, 748, The Chronicle of the Tusk. Late Winter, 4112, Year of the Tusk, Karaskand. It was as though someone had struck the back of his knees with a staff. Eleazarus stumbled forward, but was steadied by the strong arms of Lord Kinjosa, Count Palatine of Antanamera.
No, no.
Do you know what this means?
Kinjosa hissed. Eleazarus pushed the Palatine away and took two more drunken steps toward Kepharamuni's body. The gloom of his sick room was alleviated by a cluster of candles at the head of his bed. The bed itself was lavish, set between four marble columns that braced the low vaults of the ceiling, but it reeked of feces, blood, and pestilence. Kepharamuni's head lay beneath the congregated candles, but his face, it was nowhere to be seen. Where his face should have been, lay what resembled an overturned spider, its legs clutched in death about its abdomen. What had been Kepharamuni's face lay unspooled across the knuckles and shins of the steepled limbs. Eleazarus saw familiar fragments, a lone nostril, the haired ridge of an eyebrow. Beneath, he glimpsed lidless eyes and the shine of human teeth, bared and lipless. And just as that fool Scalatius had claimed, nowhere could he sense the bruise of sorcery. Kepharamuni, a Kisharum skin spy. Impossible. The Grand Master of the Scarlet Spires coughed, blinked back uncharacteristic tears. This was too much. The very air seemed nightmarish with mad implication. The ground tipped beneath his feet. Once again he felt Kinjosa steady him.
Grand Master, what does this mean?
That we're doomed? That I've led my school to its destruction?
A string of catastrophes. The disastrous losses at the Battle of Anwarat. General Set Penaris killed. 15 sorcerers of rank dead between the desert and the plague. And the disaster at Iothea, which had claimed the lives of two others. The Holy War besieged and starving. And now this, to find their hated enemy here standing with him upon the summit. How much did the Kisharum know?
We're doomed,
Eleazarus muttered.
No, Grandmaster,
Kinjosa replied, his own deep voice still tight with horror. Eleazarus turned to him. Kinjosa was a large, burly man geared for war in his ringmail hauberk, over which he wore an open Kianine coat of red silk. The white cosmetics made his strong-featured face stark against his black, square-cut beard. Kinjosa had proven himself indomitable in battle, an able commander, and in Iacchus's absence, a shrewd advisor.
We would be doomed had this abomination led us into battle.
Perhaps the gods have favored us with their afflictions.
Eleazarus stared numbly into Kinjosa's face, struck by a further terrifying thought.
You are who you are, Kinjosa.
The Palatine of Antanamera, the province that had so often proven itself the spine of High Anon, looked at him sternly.
It is me, Grandmaster.
Eleazarus studied the caste noble, and it seemed as though the man's simple, warlike strength pulled him back from the brink of despair. Kinjosa was right. This wasn't yet another catastrophe. It was a blessing of a sort. But if Kepharamuni could be replaced, there must be others.
No one is to know of this, Kinjosa. No one.
The Palatine nodded in the dim light.
If only that mandate ingrate had broken.
Remove its head,
Eleazarus said, his voice terse with growing outrage.
Then throw the carcass onto the pyre.
Acamian and Zynemus walked the ways of twilight. Between light and dark, where only shadows are known. There was no food in this place, no life-giving water, and their bodies, which they carried across their backs the way one might carry a corpse, suffered horribly. The Twilight Way, the Shadow Way, from the port city of Jokthe to Karaskand. When they passed near the camps of the enemy, they could feel the Kishorm's plucked eyes, brilliant, pure, like a lamplight before a silvered mirror, search for them from beyond the horizon. Many times a Kamian felt that otherworldly light throw shadows from their shadows. Many times a Kamian thought they were doomed, but always those eyes turned away their inhuman scrutiny, either deceived or... a Kamian could not say why. Gaining the walls, they revealed themselves beneath a small postern gate. It was night, and torches glittered between the battlements above. With Zynemus slumped against him, a Kamian called to the astonished guards, "Open the gates! I am Drusus Akamian, a mandate schoolman, and this is Cryjates Zynemus, the marshal of Atrempus. We have come to share your plight." "This city is both doomed and damned," someone shouted down. "Who seeks entry to such a place? Who but madmen or traitors?" Akamian paused before answering, struck by the bleak conviction of the man's tone. The men of the Tusk, he realized, had lost all hope. "Those who would attend their loved ones," he said, "even unto death." After a pause, the outer doors burst open and a troop of hollow-cheeked Tidoni seized them. At long last, they found themselves inside the horror of Karaskand. The temple complex of Kasakis, as Manette had heard some say, was as old as the great ziggurat of Zygoser in Shigek. It occupied the heart of the bowl, and from the limestone-paved reaches of its central campus, the Kalal, all five of the surrounding heights could be seen. In the center of the campus rose a great tree, an ancient eucalyptus that men had called Umiaki since time immemorial. Esmanet wept in its cavernous shadow, staring up at the hanging forms of Kellis and Serwe. The infant Moengus dozed in her arms, oblivious.
"Please, please wake up, Kellis, please!"
Before roaring mobs, Inkiri Gotian had stripped Kellis of his clothing, then whipped him with cedar branches until he'd bled from 100 places. Afterward, they bound his bleeding body to Serwe's nude corpse, ankle to ankle, wrist to wrist, face to face. Then they lashed the two of them, limbs outstretched, to a great bronze ring, which they hoisted and chained, upside down no less, to the winding girth of Umiaki's lowest and mightiest limb. Esmanet had wailed her voice to nothing. Now they spun in slow circles, their golden hair mingling in the breeze, their arms and legs sweeping out like those of dancers. Esmanet glimpsed ashen breasts crushed against a shining ribcage, armpit hair twisted into horns. Then Serwe's slender back rolled into view, almost mannish because of the deep line of her spine. She glimpsed her sex, bared between outspread legs, pressed against the confusion of Kellis's genitalia. Serwe, her face blackening as the blood settled, her limbs and torso carved in gray marble, as perfect in form as any artifice. And Kellis, his face sheened in sweat, his muscular back gleaming white between lines of angry red, his eyes swollen shut.
"But you said," Esmanet wailed, "you said truth can't die."
Serwe dead. Kellis dying. No matter how long she looked, no matter how deep her reason, no matter how shrill her threats, around and around, the dying and the dead, a mad pendulum. Holding Moengus close, Esmanet curled across the waxy mat of leaves. They smelled bitter where her body bruised them. "Remember when you recall the secret of battle." The Enrithi fell silent as he passed, their eyes following him as they followed kings. Nayur knew well the effect his presence worked on other men. Even beneath starred skies, he needed no gold, no herald or banner to announce the fact of his station. He wore his glory on the skin of his arms. He was Nayur Ur-Skiotha, breaker of horses and men. Others need only look to fear him.
The hunt need not end.
Shut up, shut up!
The Kalal, the broad central campus of Kasakis, teemed with piteous and despicable humanity. Along the terminus of the campus, Inrithi crowded the monumental steps of temples that looked, to Nayor's eyes, as ancient as any he'd seen in Shigek or Nansur. Others skulked beneath the pillared facades of dormitories and half-ruined cloisters. Across the outskirts, Inrithi sat upon mats and muttered to one another. Some even tended small fires, burning aromatic resins and woods, oblations, no doubt, for their warrior prophet. The crowds thickened as he neared the great tree in the Kalal's heart. He saw men wearing only shirts, their hindquarters smeared with shit. He saw others whose stomachs seemed pinned to their spines. He encountered one bare-chested fool who leapt up and down, shaking cupped hands over his head like a rattle. When Nayor shouldered the imbecile aside, something like pebbles scattered across the paving stones, he heard the madman wailing about teeth in his wake.
The secret of battle. Lies. More lies.
Heedless of the threats and curses that greeted his passage, Nayor continued battling forward, pressing through what seemed a malodorous sea of heads, elbows, and shoulders. He paused only when he could clearly view the mighty tree that men called Umiyaki. Like an immense, upturned root, it rose black and leafless into the night sky, shrouding its precincts in impenetrable darkness.
You still command the ears of the great.
No matter how hard Nayor peered, he could see nothing of the Dunyain, or Serwe.
Does he still breathe?
He cried.
Does his heart still beat?
The Inrithi massed about him turned to one another, shared looks of anxious bewilderment. No one replied.
Dog-eyed drunks!
He plowed through them in disgust, yanking men aside to move forward. Finally, he reached the perimeter of Shrial Knights, one of whom pressed a palm to his chest to hold him back. Nayor scowled until the man withdrew his hand, then peered yet again into the darkness beneath Umiyaki. He could see nothing. For a time, he pondered cutting his way to the tree. Then a procession of Shrial Knights bearing torches passed on the far side of Umiyaki, and for a fleeting moment, Nayor glimpsed his sprawled silhouette, or was it hers, against the glittering lights. The forward ranks of Inrithi began shouting, some in rapture, others in derision. Through the uproar, Nayor heard a velvety voice spoken in timbres only his heart could hear.
It's good that you've come. Proper.
Nayor stared in horror at the figure across the ring. Then the string of torches marched on, and darkness reclaimed the ground beneath Umiyaki. The surrounding clamor subsided, fractured into individual shouts.
All men, the voice said, should know their work.
I come to watch you suffer,
Nayor cried.
I come to watch you die.
In his periphery, he glimpsed men turning to him in alarm.
But why? Why would you want such a thing?
Because you betrayed me.
How? How have I betrayed you?
You need only speak, your Dunyain.
You make too much of me, more even than these Inrithi.
Because I know. I alone know what you are. I alone can destroy you.
He laughed as only a many-blooded chieftain of the Utamot could, then gestured to the darkness beneath Umiyaki.
Witness!
And my father? The hunt need not end. You know this.
Nayor stood breathless, as motionless as a horse laming stone hidden among the step grasses.
I've made a trade,
he said evenly.
I've yielded to the greater hate.
Have you?
Yes. Yes, look at her! Look at what you've done to her!
What I've done, Skilvendi, or what you've done?
She's dead! My Serwe! My Serwe is dead! My prize!
Oh, yes. What will they whisper now that your proof has passed? How will they measure?
They killed her because of you!
Laughter, full and easy-hearted, like that of a favorite uncle just into his cups. spoken like a true son of the steppe.
You mock me?
A heavy hand seized his shoulder.
Enough!
Someone was shouting.
Stow your madness! Cease speaking that foul tongue!
In a single motion, Nayor snatched the hand and twisted it about, wrenching tendon and bone. He effortlessly wheeled the fool who'd grabbed him from his place among the others. He struck the cow-faced ingrate to the ground.
Mock?
Who would dare mock a murderer?
You!
Nayor screamed at the tree. He reached out neck-breaking arms.
You killed her!
No, Skilvendi. You did. When you sold me.
To save my son!
And Nayor saw her, limp and horrified in Sarcellus's arms, blood spouting across her gown, her eyes drowning in darkness. The darkness. How many eyes had he watched it consume? He heard a babe bawling from the black.
They were supposed to kill the whore!
Nayor screamed. Several in Rethi were shouting at him now. He felt a blow glance his cheek, glimpsed the flash of steel. He grabbed a man about the head, drove his thumbs into his eyes. Something sharp pricked his thigh. Fists pounded against his back. Something, a club or a pommel, cracked against his temple. He released the man, reeling backward. He glimpsed black Umiyaki and heard the Dunyane laughing, laughing as the Utumut had laughed. Weeper!
You!
He roared, beating down men with stone-fisted blows.
You!
Suddenly the clutching, cutting mob scrambled back from a brawling figure to his right. Several cried out in apology. Nayor glanced at the man, who stood almost as tall as he, though not so broad.
Have you lost your wits, Skilvendi? It's me! Me!
You murdered Serwe. And suddenly the stranger became Coitha Sabon, dressed in a penitent's shabby robes. What kind of devilry?
Nayor, the Galioth prince exclaimed. Who are you speaking to?
You, the darkness cackled.
Skilvendi?
Nayor shook free of the man's firm grip.
This is a fool's vigil, he grated.
He spat, then turned to fight his way free of the stink.
Esme. His heart leapt at the thought. I'm coming, my sweet. I'm so very close. It seemed he could smell the musky orange of her scent. It seemed he could hear her gasps, hot against his cheek, feel her grind against his loins, desperately, as though to smother a perilous fire. It seemed he could see her throwing back her hair, a glimpse of sultry eyes and parted lips. So very close. The Taidoni, five Numanieri knights and a motley of men-at-arms, escorted them through the dark streets. The Taidoni had been courteous enough, given the circumstances of their arrival, but until someone in authority vouched for the two of them, the knights refused to say much of anything. Akamian saw other men of the Tusk on their route, most of them as wretched as the guards upon the gate. Whether sitting in windows or leaning with others against the pilasters, they stared, their faces pale and blank, their eyes impossibly bright, as though housing the fires that wasted their frames. Akamian had seen such looks before, on the fields of Eleniot, after the death of Enasarimber Kelmomus, in Great Trice, watching the fall of the Shinoth Gate, on the plains of Mengeta, awaiting the approach of dread Suruma, the look of horror and fury, of men who could only exact and never overcome, the look of apocalypse. Whenever Akamian matched their gazes, no threat or challenge was exchanged, only the thoughtless understanding of exhausted brothers. Something, demon or reptile, crawled into the skulls of those who endured the unendurable, and when it looked out their eyes, as it inevitably did, it could recognize itself in others. He belonged, Akamian realized, not just here in Karaskant with those he loved, but here with the Holy War. He belonged with these men, even unto death. We share the same doom. Moving slowly for Zynemus's sake, they trudged between two heights whose names Akamian didn't know and into an area one of the Numanieri had called the Bowl, where Proyas and his household were supposedly quartered. They passed through a veritable labyrinth of streets and alleyways,
and more than once the knights had to ask passers-by for directions. Despite everything, the prospect of finding Kellis and Esmanet, of seeing Proyas after so many bitter months, Akamian found himself pondering the carelessness of his declaration beneath Karaskan's walls. "I am Drusus Akamian, a Mandate schoolman." How long had it been since he'd last spoken those words aloud? A Mandate schoolman. Was that what he was? And if so, why did he shy from the thought of contacting at Ursus? In all likelihood, they'd learned of his abduction. They were certain to have informants he knew nothing about among the Kunryan contingent, at least. He imagined they assumed him dead. So why not contact them? The threat of the second apocalypse hadn't dwindled during his captivity. And the dreams, they racked him as they ever did. "Because I'm no longer one of them." For all the ferocity with which he defended the Gnosis, to the point of sacrificing Zynemus, he'd forsaken the Mandate. He'd forsaken them, he realized, even before his abduction by the Scarlet Spires. He'd forsaken them for Kellis. I was going to teach him the Gnosis. Even to think this stole his breath, reminded him that so much more than Esmanet awaited him within these walls. The old mysteries surrounding Mathanet, the threat of the Consult and their skin spies, the promise and enigma of an Asarimber Kellis, the premonitions of the second apocalypse. But even as his skin pimpled with dread, something balked within him, something old and obdurate, as callous as crocodiles. "Let the mysteries rot," he found himself thinking. "Let the world crash about us." For he was Drusus Akamian, a man like any other, and he would have his lover, his wife, his Esmanet. Like so many things in the aftermath of Iothea, the rest seemed childish, like tropes in an overread book. "I know you live, I know it." At long last, their small troop came to a pause before the faceless walls of some compound. Zynemus at his side, Akamian watched while two of the Numanieri knights fell to arguing with the guards posted before the compound's gate. He turned at the sound of his friend's voice.
"Akka,"
Zynemus said, scowling in his queer, eyeless fashion.
"When we walked the shadows."
The marshal hesitated, and for a moment, Akamian feared an onslaught of recriminations. Before Iothea, the notion of using sorcery to slip past the enemy would have been unthinkable for Zynemus, and yet he'd acquiesced with scarcely a complaint when Akamian had suggested the possibility in Jokthe. Did he repent, or had he, like Akamian, been gouged of his previous cares as well?
"I'm blind," Zynemus continued. "Blind as blind could be, Akka. And yet, I saw them. The Kisharim. I saw them seeing."
Akamian pursed his lips, troubled by the fear-to-hope tone of the marshal's voice.
"You did see," he said carefully. "In a manner. There's many ways of seeing, and all of us possess eyes that never breach skin. Men are wrong to think nothing lies between blindness and sight." "And the Kisharim?" Zynemus pressed. Is that how they—"
"The Kisharim are masters of this interval. They blind themselves, they say, to better see the world between. According to some, it's the key to their metaphysics."
"So?"
Zynemus began, unable to contain the passion in his voice.
"Not now, Zin,"
Akamian said, watching the most senior of the Tidoni knights, a choleric thane called Anmergle, stride toward them from the compound gate.
"Some other time."
In broken but workable Shaik, Anmergle stated that Proyas's people had agreed to take them, despite their better judgment.
"No one steals into Karaskand," he explained. "Only out."
Then, heedless of any reply they might make, he barged past them, yelling out to his troops. At the same time, men-at-arms, dressed as Kianin but bearing the black eagle of House Nersay on their shields, appeared from the darkness. Within moments, Akamian and Zynemus found themselves ushered into the compound. They were greeted by an emaciated steward dressed in the threadbare yet lustrous white and black livery of Proyas's house. Soldiers in tow, the man led them down a carpeted hallway. They passed a Kianin woman, a slave no doubt, kneeling in the doorway of an adjoining chamber,
and Akamian found himself shocked, not by her obvious terror, but by the fact that she was the first Kianine he'd seen since entering Karaskand. No wonder the city seemed a tomb. They rounded a corner and found themselves in a tall antechamber. Set between two corpulent pillars, Nilnameshi by the look of them, a door of greening bronze lay partially ajar. The steward ducked his head in. Nodding to someone unseen, he pressed the door open, and after a nervous glance at Zynemus, gestured for them to follow. Akamian cursed the knot in his gut, then found himself staring at Nersei Proyas. Though more haggard and far thinner, his linen tunic hung from shoulders like sword pommels. The crown prince of Khanraya still looked much the same. The shock of curly black hair, which his mother had both cursed and adored, the trim beard etching a jaw that, though not as youthful as it once was, remained set in the old way, the nimble brow, and of course the lucid brown eyes, which were deep enough, it seemed, to contain any admixture of passion, no matter how contradictory.
"What is it?" Zynemus asked. "What happens?"
"Proyas," Akamian said. He cleared his throat.
"It's Proyas, Zin."
The Khanraian prince stared at Zynemus, his face expressionless. He advanced two steps from a lavishly worked table in what must have been his bedchamber. As though from a stupor, he said,
"What happened?"
Akamian said nothing, struck dumb by a rush of unexpected passions. He felt his face grow hot with fury. Zynemus stood beside him, absolutely motionless.
"Speak up!"
Proyas commanded, his voice ringing with desperation. "What happened?" "The scarlet spires took his eyes," Akamian said evenly, as a way to... Without warning, the young prince flew to Zynemus, clutched him in a wild embrace, not cheek to cheek as between men, but as a child might, with his forehead pressed against the marshal's collar. He shuddered with sobs. Zynemus clutched the back of his head with thick fingers, crushed his beard against his scalp. A moment of fierce silence passed.
"Zin," Proyas hissed, "please forgive me. Please, I beg of you."
"Shh. It's enough to feel your embrace, to hear your voice."
"But Zin, your eyes, your eyes."
"Shh, now. Akka will fix me, you'll see."
Akamian flinched at the words. Hope was never so poison as when it deluded loved ones. Gasping, Proyas pressed his cheek against the marshal's shoulder. His glittering look found Akamian, and for a moment they gazed unblinking, each at the other.
"You too, old teacher,"
the young man croaked.
"Can you find it in your heart to forgive?"
Though Akamian heard the words clearly, they seemed to reach him as though from a great distance, their speaker too distant to truly matter. No, he realized, he couldn't forgive, not because his heart had hardened, but because it had receded. He saw the boy, Prussia, whom he'd once loved, but he saw a stranger as well, a man who walked questionable and competing paths, a man of faith, a murderous fanatic. How could he think these men were his brothers? With his face as blank as he could manage, Akamian said, "I'm a teacher no longer." Proyas squeezed shut his eyes. They were hooded in the old way when he opened them. Whatever hardships the Holy War had endured, Proyas, the judge, had survived. "Where are they?" Akamian asked. The circles were so much clearer now. Aside from Zynemus, only Esmanet and Kellis possessed any claim to his heart. In the whole world, only they mattered. Proyas visibly stiffened, pressed himself from Zynemus's breast.
"Hasn't anyone told you?"
"No one would tell us anything," Zynemus said. "They feared we were spies."
Akamian couldn't breathe.
"Esmanet?"
he gasped. The prince swallowed, a stricken look upon his face.
"No, Esmanet is safe."
He ran a hand through his cropped hair, both anxious and ominous. Somewhere, a wick sizzled in a guttering candle.
"And Kallus?"
Zynemus asked.
"What about him?"
"You must understand. Much, very much has happened."
Zynemus pawed the air before him as though needing to touch those he spoke to.
What are you saying, Bryos?
I'm saying Kellis is dead. Of all Karaskand, only the Great Bazaar carried any memory of the steppe, and even then it was only the bones of such a memory, its flatness purchased by masons, its openness enclosed by dark-windowed facades. No grasses grew between the paving stones.
Swazond, he had said. The man you have killed is gone from the world, Sirway. He exists only here, a scar upon your arm. It is the mark of his absence, of all the ways his soul will not move, and of all the acts he will not commit, a mark of the weight you now bear.
And she had replied, I don't understand. Such a dear fool, that girl, so innocent. Nayor lay against the ribbed belly of a dead horse, surrounded by ever-widening circles of Kianine dead, victims of the city's glorious sack 3 weeks before.
I will bear you, he said to the blackness,
and never, it seemed, had he uttered a mightier oath.
You will not want, so long as my back is strong.
Traditional words uttered by the groom as the memorialist braided his hair in marriage. He raised the knife to his throat. Bound to a circle, swinging from the limb of a dark tree. Bound to Sirway, cold and lifeless against him. Sirway, spinning in slow circles. A fly crawled across her cheek, paused before a breathless nostril. He puffed air across her dead skin, and the fly was gone. Must keep her clean. Her eyes half open, papyrus dry.
Sirway, breathe, girl, breathe. I command it.
I come before you, I come before. Bound skin to skin to Sirway.
What have I?
What? What? A convulsion of some kind.
No, no. I must focus. I must assess.
Unblinking eyes staring down black cheeks out to the stars.
There's no circumstance beyond.
No circumstance beyond.
Logos. I'm one of the conditioned.
From his shins to his cheek, he could feel her, radiating a cold as deep as her bones.
Breathe, breathe.
Dry, and so still, so impossibly still. Father, please, please make her breathe. I can walk no farther. Face so dark, mottled like something from the sea, how had she ever smiled?
Focus.
What happens? All is in disarray, and they've killed her. They've murdered my wife. I gave her to them.
What did you say?
I gave her to them.
Why? Why would you do this?
For you.
For them.
Something dropped within him, and he tumbled into sleep, cold water rinsing bruised and broken skin. Dreams followed, dark tunnels, weary earth. A ridge, curved like a sleeping woman's hip, against the night sky. And upon it, two silhouettes, black against clouds of stars, impossibly bright. The figure of a man seated, shoulders crouched like an ape, legs crossed like a priest. And a tree with branches that swept up and out, forking across the bowl of the night. And about the nail of heaven, the stars revolved, like clouds hurried across winter skies. And Kellis stared at the figure, stared at the tree, but he could not move. The firmament cycled as though night after night passed without day. Framed by the wheeling heavens, the figure spoke, a million throats in his throat, a million mouths in his mouth.
What do you see?
The silhouette stood, hands clasped like a monk, legs bent like a beast.
Tell me.
Whole worlds wailed in terror. The warrior prophet awoke, his skin tingling against a dead woman's cheek. More convulsions.
Father, what happens to me?
Pang upon pang, wresting away his face, beating it into a stranger's.
You weep.
The Zaudunyani on the heights of the bull immediately recognized him as a friend of the warrior prophet, and Akamian found himself in a bright reception hall, blinking at ivory plaques set in glossy black marble. After several moments, an Ainani caste noble called Gaia Macri, one of the Nascenti, the others said, arrived and escorted him down dark halls. When Akamian asked him about the white-clad warriors he saw posted throughout the palace, the man yammered on about riots and the evil machinations of the Orthodox, but Akamian only had ears for his leaping heart. At long last, they paused before two grand doors, cherrywood beneath bronze fretting, and Akamian found himself thinking of jokes he could use to make her laugh. From a sorcerer's tent to a caste noble's suite. He could almost hear her laughter, almost see her eyes, wanton with love and devilry. So what will it be the next time I die? The Endymion Heights? She likely sleeps, Gaia Macri said apologetically. Things have been especially hard on her. Jokes. What could he be thinking? She would need him, fiercely, if what Proyas had said was true. Serwe dead and Kellis dying, the Holy War starving, she would need him to hold her. How he would hold her. Without warning, Gaia Macri whirled, clutched his hands. Please, he hissed. You must save him. You must. The man fell to his knees, held him with white-knuckled fervor. You were his teacher. I'll do what I can, Akamian stammered. On that I give you my word. Tears branched across the man's cheeks into his beard. He pressed his forehead to Akamian's hands. Thank you. Thank you. At a loss for words, Akamian pulled the Nascenti to his feet. The man fussed with his yellow and white robes, pathetically, as though just remembering a lifetime obsession with Jinan. You'll remember? He gasped. Of course, Akamian replied. But first I must confer with Esmanet. Alone. Do you understand? Gaia Macri nodded. He backed away 3 steps, then turned and fled down the hall. He stood before the tall doors, breathing. Esme. He would hold her while she sobbed. He would speak his every thought, tell her what she'd meant to him through his captivity. He would tell her that he, a mandate schoolman, would take her as his wife. His wife! And her eyes would weep wonder. He almost laughed with joy. At last! Rather than knocking, he pressed through the doors the way a husband might. Gloom and the scent of vanilla and balsam greeted him. Only 6 scattered candles illuminated the suite, which was broad with vaulted ceilings and decked with a luxurious array of carpets, screens, and hangings. Set upon a raised dais, a great pentagonal bed dominated the room's heart, its sheets and blankets knotted as though by passion. To the left, the paneled walls opened onto what looked like a private garden. Outside, the sky was bright with stars. A sorcerer's tent, indeed. He stepped from the lane of light thrown by the doors, peering into the suite's deeper reaches. The bed was empty, he could see that through the gauze. The doors rattled shut behind him, giving him a start. Where was she? Then his eyes found her on the far side of the room, curled up on a small couch with her back to the doors, to him. Her hair looked longer, almost purple in the gloom. Her loose gown had fallen, revealing a slender shoulder, both brown and pale. His arousal was immediate, both joyous and desperate. How many times had he kissed that skin? Kissing. That was how he would awaken her, crying while kissing her naked shoulder. She would stir, think he was a dream. No, it can't be you. You're dead. Then he would take her, with slow, fierce tenderness, rack her with voluptuous rapture, and she would know that at long last her heart had returned. I've come back for you, Esme, from death and agony. He descended the landing before the doors, only to halt when she suddenly bolted upright. She looked about in alarm, then stared at him with swollen and incredulous eyes. For an instant, she seemed a stranger to him. He saw her with the same youthful and ardent eyes that had discovered her in Sumna so many years ago. Coltish beauty, freckled cheeks, full lips and perfect teeth. There was a breathless moment between them. Esme, he whispered, unable to say anything else. He'd forgotten how beautiful. For a heartbeat, she radiated abject horror, as though she looked upon a wraith. But then, miraculously it seemed, she flew to him,
her small, bare feet wing-like with desperation. Then they were together, recklessly clutching one another. She felt so small, so slender in his arms.
"Oh, Akka,"
she sobbed.
"You were dead. Dead."
"No, no, no, my sweet," he murmured, and let loose a shuddering breath.
"Akka, Akka, oh, Akka."
He ran a shaking hand across the back of her head. Her hair felt like silk against his palm, soothing silk, and her smell, incense soft and woman musky. "Shush, Esme," he whispered. "Everything will be all right. We're together again. Please let me kiss you." But she cried louder.
"You must save him, Akamian. You must save him."
Small confusions, stirring like vermin. "Save him? Esme, what do you mean?" His arms slackened. She thrust herself from his embrace, stumbled back in terror as though remembering some horrible truth.
"Kill us,"
she said, her lips trembling. Akamian beat at the whining fear that flared through him. "What do you mean, Esme?" He could feel the blood drop from his face.
"Don't you see? They're killing him."
"Kill us?" "Yes. Of course, I'll do everything I can to save him. But please, Esme, let me hold you. I need to hold you."
"You must save him, Akamian. You can't let them kill him."
Flare of dread, undeniable this time. "No, must be reasonable. She's suffered as much as I have. She's just not as strong. I won't let anyone do anything to him, I swear it, but just, please." "Esme, what have you done?" Her face collapsed about some impossible fact. She sobbed.
He's.
Curious sensation, as though submerged in water with lungs emptied of air. "Yes, Esme, he's the warrior prophet I too believe. I'll do everything I can to save him."
"No, Akamian."
Her face was now dead, in the way of those who must carve distances, cut wide what was once close. "Don't say it. Please don't say it." He looked about the extravagant room, gesturing with his hands. He tried to laugh, then said, "Some sorcerer's tent, eh?" A sob knifed the back of his throat. What will it be the next time I die? The Andiamine? He tried to smile.
"Akka,"
she whispered.
"I carry his child."
Whore, after all. Akamian passed between the congregated in Rethi, between the signal fires of the Shrial Knights, little more than a shadow thrown by an otherworldly sun. He remembered the screams and crashing walls of Iothea. He remembered blasting hallways through stone and burnt brick. Oh, he knew the might of his song, the thunder of his world-breaking voice, and he knew the bitter rapture of vengeance. A great tree soared into the night sky, a hoary old eucalyptus too ancient not to be named. His first thought was to set it alight, to transform it into a blazing beacon of his wrath, a funeral pyre for the betrayer, the seducer. But he could sense the absences that encircled the man, the three Kore the men of the Tusk had bound to his bronze ring, and he could see that he suffered. Akamian crept beneath the tree, onto the mat of fallen leaves. He clutched his knees and rocked to and fro in the darkness. There she was, an impossible fact made flesh. Serwe, dead. And there he was, hanging with her, limb to limb, breast to breast. Kellis, naked, slowly rolling as though the ring unraveled the long string of his life. How could such things come to pass? Akamian ceased rocking and sat still. He listened to the hemp creak in the breeze. He smelled eucalyptus and death. His body calmed, became the cold vessel of his fury and heartbreak. Beyond the Shrial Knights encircling the tree, thousands packed the surrounding campus, singing hymns and dirges for their warrior prophet. The cry of a flute pierced the din, wandering, trailing, rising in grief-stricken crescendos, calling out the same godless prayer, the howl, almost animal in its intensity. Akamian hugged himself in the darkness. How could such things? Thumb and forefinger pressed hard against his eyes, shivering, cold, heart like rags bundled about cold stone. He lifted his face, raised chin and brow to his hate. Tears streamed down his cheeks.
How could you betray me like this? You, the two people, the only two. You knew how empty my life had been. You knew. I can't understand. I try, but I can't understand. How could you do this to me?
Images boiled through his thoughts, Esmonette gasping beneath the hot plunge of Kellis's hips, the brushing of breathless lips, her startled cry, her climax, the two of them, naked and entwined beneath blankets, staring at the light of a single candle, and Kellis asking, "How did you bear that man? How did you ever bring yourself to lie with a sorcerer?" "He fed me. He was a warm, plump pillow with gold in his pockets. But he wasn't you, my love. No one is you." His mouth was wrenched open by a soft, inarticulate cry.
"How? Why?"
Then savagery.
"I could break you, Kellis. See you burn. Burn until your eyes burst, dog. Treacherous dog. I'll see you shriek until you gag on your own heart, until your limbs snap for agony. I can do it. I can burn hosts with my song. I can pack the anguish of 1,000 men into your skin. With tongue and teeth I can peel you to nothing, grind your corpse to chalk."
He began weeping. The dark world about him buzzed and burned.
"Damn you,"
he gasped. He couldn't breathe. Where was the air to breathe? He rolled his head like a boy whose anger had been stripped hollow by hurt. He beat an awkward fist against the dead leaves.
"Damn you. Damn you. Damn you."
He looked around numbly and wiped at his face with a half-hearted sleeve, sniffled and tasted the salt of tears in the back of his throat.
"You've made a whore of her, Kellis. You've made a whore of my Esme."
They swayed round in shadowy circles. The sound of laughter carried on the night wind. The dark trees seemed to exhale an endless, ambient breath.
"Akamian?"
Kellis whispered. The words winded him, struck him, dumb with horror.
"No, he's not allowed to speak."
"He said you would come,"
spoken from a dead woman's cheek. Kellis stared as though from the surface of a coin, his dark eyes glittering, his face pressed against Serwe's, whose head had drawn back in rigor, gaping mouth filled with dusty teeth. For a moment it seemed that he lay spread-eagle across a mirror, and that Serwe was no more than his reflection. Akamian shuddered.
"What have they done to you?"
Impossibly, the ring had ceased its ponderous revolutions.
"I see them, Akamian. They walk among us, hidden in ways you cannot see."
"The consult." His hackles stirred. Cold sweat set his skin afire.
"The no-god returns, Akka. I've seen him. He is, as you said, Tsuruma, Mog Farao."
"Lies," Akamian cried. "Lies to spare you my wrath."
"My Nascenti, tell them to show you what lies in the garden."
"What? What lies in the garden?"
But the shining eyes were closed. A grievous howl echoed across the Kalal, chilling blood and drawing men with torches to the blackness beneath Umiaki. The ring continued its endless roll.
Dawn light streamed over the balcony and through the gauze, etching the bedchamber in radiant surfaces and pockets of black shadow. Stirring in his bed, Proyas scowled at the light, raised an arm against it. For several heartbeats, he lay utterly still, trying to swallow away the pain at the back of his throat, the last residue of the hemoplexy. Then the shame and remorse of the previous evening came flooding back. Akamian and Zynemus had returned. Akka and Zin, both of them irrevocably transformed. Because of me. A cold morning breeze tossed through the shears. Proyas huddled, hoarding whatever warmth his blankets offered. He tried to doze, but found himself fencing with worry and dismay instead. In his boyhood, He'd cherished the luxurious laziness of such mornings. He drifted through legends and fancies, dreaming of all the great things he was destined to accomplish. He studied the shadows thrown by the morning sun and wondered at the way they crept across the walls. On cold mornings like this one, he wrapped his blankets around him, savoring them the way the elderly savored hot baths. The warmth had never stopped short of his bones as it did now. Some time passed before Proyas realized someone watched him. At first he simply blinked, too astonished to move or shout. Both the decor and the design of the compound were Nilnameshi. Aside from extravagantly detailed imagery, the chamber possessed low ceilings propped with fat and fluted columns imported, no doubt, from Invishi or Sapathure. Almost invisible for the morning glare, a figure reclined against one of the columns flanking the balcony. Proyas shot forward from the covers.
A Kamian?
Several heartbeats passed before his eyes adjusted enough to recognize the man.
What are you doing, Akamian? What do you want?
Esmanet, the sorcerer said. Kellis has taken her as his wife. Did you know that?
Proyas gaped at the schoolman, robbed of his outrage by something in his voice. A queer kind of drunkenness, a recklessness, but born of loss instead of drink.
I knew, he admitted, squinting at Akamian's figure. But I thought that...
He trailed and swallowed.
Kellis will soon be dead.
He immediately felt a fool. It sounded like he offered compensation.
Esmanet is lost to me, Akamian said.
The sorcerer's expression was little more than a shadow against the glare, but somehow Proyas could see its exhausted resolve.
But how could you say that? You don't—
Where's Inemus?
The schoolman interrupted. Proyas raised his eyebrows, gestured with a leftward tilt of his head.
One wall over, he said. The next room.
Akamian pursed his lips.
Did he tell you?
About his eyes? Proyas looked to the outline of his feet beneath the vermilion covers.
No, I hadn't the courage to ask.
I assumed that the spires—
Because of me, Proyas. They blinded him as a way to coerce me.
The message was obvious. It's not your fault, he was saying. Proyas raised a hand as though to pinch more sleep from his eyes. He wiped away tears instead.
Damn you, Akka. I don't need your protection.
For the Gnosis?
He asked.
Was that what they wanted?
Cridates Zynemus, a marshal of Conraya, blinded for blasphemy's sake.
In part. They also thought I had information regarding the Kisharum.
Kisharum?
Akamian snorted.
The Scarlet Spires are terrified, did you know that? Terrified of what they cannot see.
It stands to reason. All they do is hide. Eleazarus still refuses to take the field, even though I'm told they've begun boiling their books out of hunger.
I doubt they stray far from their latrines,
Akamian said, the old twinkle surfacing through the exhaustion of his voice. The rot they read. Proyas laughed, and an almost forgotten sense of comfort stole over him. This, he realized, was how they'd once talked, their cares and worries directed outward rather than at each other. But instead of taking heart at the realization, Proyas suffered only more dismay, understanding that what trust and camaraderie had once given them, only dread and exhaustion could now deliver. A long silence passed between them, fueled by the sudden collapse of their good humor. Proyas found his gaze wandering to the trains of priapic revelers, brown-skinned and half-nude, that marched across the painted walls, their arms filled with various bounty. With every passing heartbeat, it seemed the silence buzzed louder. Then Akamian said,
Kellis cannot die.
Proyas pursed his lips. But of course, he said numbly. I say he must die, so you say he must live. He glanced, not without nervousness, at his nearby work table. The parchment sat in plain view, its raised corners translucent in the sun. Mathenet's letter.
This has nothing to do with you, Proyas. I am past you.
The tone, as much as the words, chilled Proyas to the pith.
Then why are you here?
Because of all the great names, only you can understand. Understand.
Proyas repeated, feeling the old impatience rekindled in his heart. Understand what? No, let me guess. Only I can understand the significance of the name Anasarimba. Only I can understand the peril.
Enough! Akamian shouted. Can't you see that when you make light of these matters, you make light of me? When have I ever scoffed at the Tusk? When have I ever mocked the latter prophet? When?
Prius caught his retort, which had been all the harsher for the truth of what Akamian said.
Kellis, he said, has already been judged.
Have care, Proyas. Remember King Shykol. For the Enrithi, the name Shykol, the Zarashi king who had condemned Inri Sejanus, was synonymous with hatred and tragic presumption. The thought that his own name might someday possess the same poison caused Proyas no small terror.
Shykol was wrong. I am right.
It all came down to truth.
I wonder, Akamian said, what Shykol would say.
What? Proyas exclaimed. So the great skeptic thinks a new prophet walks among us? Come, Akka, it's too absurd.
These are Confucius' words. Another unkind thought. Akamian paused, but whether out of care or hesitation, Proyas couldn't tell.
I'm not sure what he is. All I know is that he's too important to die.
Sitting rigid in his bed, Proyas peered against the sun, struggling to see his old teacher. Aside from his outline against the blue pillar, the most he could discern were the five lines of white that streaked the black of his beard. Proyas sighed loudly through his nostrils, looked down to his thumbs.
I thought much the same not so long ago, he admitted. I worried that what Confis and the others said was true, that he was the reason the anger of the god burned against us. But I'd shared too many cups with a man not to realize he's more than simply remarkable. But then,
from nowhere, it seemed, a great cloud crawled before the sun, and a dim chill fell across the room. For the first time, Proyas could see his old teacher clearly. The haggard face, the forlorn eyes and meditative brow, the blue smock and woolen travel robes, soiled black about the knees. So poor. Why did Akamian always look so poor?
Then what?
The schoolman asked, apparently unconcerned with his sudden visibility. Proyas heaved another sigh, glanced once again at the parchment upon his table. Distant thunder rumbled in on the wind, which whisked through the black cedars below.
Well, he continued, first there was the Skilvendi, his hatred of Kellis. I thought to myself, how could this man who knows Kellis better than any other, despise him so?
Serwe, Akamian said. Kellis once told me the barbarian loved Serwe. Neyor said much the same when I first asked him. But there was something about his manner, that made me think there was more. He's such a fierce and melancholy man, and complicated, very complicated.
His skin is too thin, Akamian said, but I suppose it scars well.
A sour smirk was the most Proyas could afford.
There's more to Neyor Ur-Skiotha than you know, Akka, mark me. In some ways, he's as extraordinary as Kellis. Be thankful he's our pet, and not the Padi Raja's.
Your point, Proyas.
The Kunrayan prince frowned.
The point is that I questioned him about Kellis again, shortly after we found ourselves besieged.
And?
And he told me to go ask Kellis himself. That was when...
He hesitated, groping in vain for some delicate way to continue. More thunder piled through the balcony doorways.
That was when I found Esmanet in his bed.
Akamian closed his eyes for a moment. When he opened them, his gaze was steady.
And your misgivings became genuine doubts. I'm touched.
Proyas chose to ignore the sarcasm.
After that, I no longer dismissed Confis's arguments out of hand. I mulled things over for a time, at once anguished by all that happened still, and terrified that if I sided with Confis and the others, I would be striking sparks over tinder.
You feared war between the Orthodox and the Zaudunyani.
And I fear it still,
Proyas fairly cried,
though it scarcely seems to matter with the Padi Raja waiting with his desert wolves.
How could it all come to this? Such a pass.
So what decided you?
The Skilvendi, Proyas said with a shrug. Confis brought forward witnesses who claimed to know a man from the northern caravans, a man who, before he died in the desert, claimed that Atrathau had no princes.
Hearsay, Akamian said. Worthless, you know that. It was probably a ploy on Confis's part. Dead men have a habit of telling the most convenient tales.
Which is what I thought, until the Skilvendi confirmed the story.
Akamian leaned forward, his brow knotted in angry shock.
Confirmed? What do you mean?
He called Kellis a prince of nothing. The schoolman sat rigid for a time, his eyes lost in the space between them. He knew the penalties for transgressing caste, all men did. The caste nobles of the Three Seas cherished their ancestor scrolls for more than spiritual or sentimental reasons.
He could be lying, Akamian mused. As a way to regain possession of Serwe, maybe.
He could be, given the way he reacted to her execution.
Serwe executed, the sorcerer exclaimed. How could such a thing happen? Proyas, how could you let such a thing happen? She was just...
Ask Gotian, Proyas blurted.
Trying them according to the tusk was his idea, his. He thought it would legitimize the affair, make it seem less...
Like what it was?
Akamian cried. A conspiracy of frightened caste nobles trying to protect their power and privilege?
That depends, Proyas replied stiffly, on whom you ask.
Either way, we needed to forestall war, and so far...
Heaven forfend, Akamian snapped, that men murder men for faith.
And heaven forfend that fools perish for their folly. And heaven forfend that mothers miscarry, that children put out their eyes. Heaven forfend that anything horrible happen. I couldn't agree with you more, Akka.
He smiled sarcastically, to think he'd almost missed the blasphemous old bastard.
But back to the point. I did not condemn Kellis out of hand, old tutor. Many things, many, compelled me to vote with the others. Prophet or not, Anassarimba Kellis is dead.
Akamian had been watching him, his face emptied of expression.
Who said he was a prophet?
Enough, Akka, please! You just said he was too important to die.
He is, Proyas, he is. He's our only hope.
Proyas rubbed more sleep from the corner of his eyes. He let go a long, exasperated breath.
So, the second apocalypse, is it? Is Kellis the second coming of Seswatha?
He shook his head.
Please, please tell—
He's more, the schoolman cried with alarming passion.
Far more than Seswatha, as he must be. The Heron Spear is lost, destroyed when the Skilvendi sacked ancient Kanae. If the consult were to succeed a second time, if the No God were to walk again—
Akamian stared, his eyes rounded in horror.
Men would have no hope.
Proyas had endured many of these small rants since his childhood. What made them so uncanny and at the same time so intolerable was the way Akamian spoke, as though he recounted rather than conjectured. Just then, the morning sun flashed anew between a crease in the accumulating clouds. The thunder, however, continued to rumble across wretched Karaskand.
Akka.
The schoolman silenced him with an outstretched hand.
You once asked me, Proyas, whether I had more than dreams to warrant my fears, do you remember?
All too well. It was the same night Akamian had asked him to write to Maisonette.
I remember, yes.
Without warning, Akamian stood and stepped out onto the balcony. He vanished into the morning glare only to reappear moments afterward, hoisting something dark in his hands. By some coincidence, the sun vanished the moment Proyas reached out to shield his eyes. He stared at the soil and blood-stained bundle. A pungent odor slowly filled the room.
Look at it,
Akamian commanded, brandishing it.
Look! Then send your quickest riders out to the great names.
Proyas recoiled, clutched at the covers about his knees. Suddenly he realized what it seemed he'd known all along. Akamian wouldn't relent. And of course not. He was a mandate schoolman.
Maisonette, most holy shrier, is this what you would have me do? Is it?
Certainty and doubt. That was what was holy, that.
Save your warren for the others, Proyas muttered.
With a flourish, he kicked free the sheets and strode naked to the nearby table. The floor was cold enough to ache. Shivers chattered across his skin. He snatched Mathanet's missive, held it out to the scowling sorcerer.
"Read it," he murmured.
Lightning threaded the sky beyond the ruined citadel of the dog. Akamian set down his reeking bundle, grasped the parchment, scanned it. Proyas noticed the black crescents under his fingernails. Instead of looking up in stunned shock as Proyas had expected, the sorcerer frowned and squinted at the sheet. He even held it to what light remained. The room trembled to the crack of thunder.
"Mathanet?" the sorcerer asked, his eyes still riveted to the Shrya's flawless script.
Proyas knew the line, he pondered. The impossible always left the deepest marks on the soul.
"Assist Drusus Akamian, though he is a blasphemer, for in this wickedness the holy shall also follow."
Akamian set the sheet upon his lap, though he still pinched the corner with his thumb and forefinger. The two men shared a thoughtful gaze. Confusion and relief warred in his old teacher's eyes.
"Aside from my sword, my harness, and my ancestors," Proyas said, "that letter is the only thing I brought across the desert, the only thing I saved."
"Call them," Akamian said. "Summon the others to council."
Gone was the golden morning. Rain poured from black skies.